Welcome to page 7. We're here with Noah's covenant and it's breaking. You'll see the boat picture, the picture of the ark at the top, and the picture of the tent at the bottom. We will get to both of these. But first I wanted to say, isn't it incredibly fortunate that we are on page 7 on a covenant page? Because 7 means covenant. I want you to remember that. 7 means covenant. It's important. Okay, let's introduce Noah. We know that Noah is a descendant of Seth. He's from the good line, the quote-unquote sons of God line. And all the world around him basically has been seduced by the devil and it is going bad. As a matter of fact, Genesis 6:11 says, "Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all the flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark," etc., etc. Okay, so he basically picks Noah. I should back up a little bit. Genesis 6:9. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God, and Noah had 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So Noah is basically the only one who's still walking with God. God tells him to build an ark. Tradition tells us that Noah's a farmer. He's probably never seen an ark before, okay? He's not really qualified. That's a theme we'll see, the unqualified being called. But in Hebrews 11:7, and then in 2 Peter 2:5, they talk about Noah, and it says he was preaching and building for a long time, but nobody would come. Nobody would come get in the ark with him and his family. That's not explicitly said here in Genesis, but that's told us later in Hebrews and in 2 Peter. So we see some Jewish oral tradition accompanying the scriptures, which is pretty cool. Okay, so this is kind of the timeline of things. First, he builds the ark. He builds the ark for 7 years, and then he gets on and, by the way, waits for 7 days before it starts to rain. Can you imagine sitting in the ark being like, wait, were we actually supposed to get in here? Because I thought that it was supposed to rain. But God tells him, Genesis 7:4, "For in 7 days I will send rain upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing I will made will be blot out from the earth." So he gets onto the ark 7 days early, they wait it out, and then the rain comes. So first he builds the ark. Second, the rain comes. The rain comes, it rains for 40 days, 40 nights. Third, they seem to be floating around in the ark for 150 days before dry land appears. During this time, he sends out a couple birds. He sends out a raven first, and then he sends out a dove. They're looking for land. The idea is that if the birds find a place to live and find land, then they won't come back, right? So Genesis, where are we? 7:12, "And rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Genesis 7:24, "And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Genesis 8:4, "And in the 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest upon the mountain of Ararat. Genesis 8:6, "At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made and sent forth a raven, and it went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove above him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him on the ark, for the waters were still high on the face of the whole earth. So he put forth his hand and took her in and brought her into the ark with him, and he waited for another 7 days, and then sent forth the dove out of the ark." Okay, and then the earth is dry, and then they land. So all of this is kind of, you know, passing by in Genesis 8 here. The flood subsides, and then God makes a covenant with Noah after all of this is done. So he has survived. He is one of the 8 survivors on earth, okay? He and his wife, 3 sons, 3 wives. Doesn't seem like there's any grandkids yet. They are the only 8 people here, okay? And God makes a covenant with them that sounds remarkably like the covenant with Abraham, okay? The sign of this covenant is like the rainbow. The idea is that it looks like an arrow, a bow and arrow, shooting away from the earth. God has turned his vengeance away from the earth and up towards the heavens. It's not pointed at the up at the, he's not going to be attacking the earth anymore. And now let's talk a little bit about the covenant. Covenant is on Genesis 9. So check this out. This is a renewal of the Adam's covenant, and you can see it in so many ways. I'm going to make a little chart here. So if you want to make a chart with me, it's 6 boxes on one side and 6 boxes on another side to show how Adam and Noah line up. So on Adam's side, the first thing is that there is like a garden with Eden, with animals. And on Noah's side, he's got like a floating Eden on the ark, lots of animals, right? On Adam's side, the world emerges from the waters of the deep in creation. But on Noah's side, the world disappears into the waters of the flood and the deep. On Adam's side, there's this whole seven-day thing. There's 7 days of creation and rest. And in Noah's side, there's lots of sevens. 7 days in the ark until the water comes, 7 months until resting on top of the mountain, 7 days between the birds being sent out, 7 days of the ark being built, lots of sevens, okay? In Adam's covenant, the Spirit hovered over the water at creation, over the face of the deep, the beginning of Genesis. And in Noah's, we've got two things. The raven is like darkness hovering over the water, unlike the Spirit, right? And then the dove, who is a sign of the Spirit hovering over the water. So we've kind of got like a two-for-one special there. In Adam's covenant, it's just man, just Adam and Eve, and he's told to subdue the earth. Like it's a fresh, clean slate. And in Noah's covenant, it's just him and his family told to subdue the earth and have dominion. And finally, in Adam's covenant, the breaking of the covenant has to do with a garden, fruit, nakedness, a curse, and a bad son named Cain. And in the breaking of Noah's covenant, it has to do with a garden, fruit, nakedness, a curse, and a bad son named Canaan. Whew! All right, we got to get into this how it is broken situation, okay? Make sure that you read for yourself Genesis 8 and 9 to see the actual flood account. We are here in 9, starting with 18, and what we call, I call this the shady tent situation. And I don't mean shady like nice, luscious shade. I mean like, that's shady. That's a little weird. Like, we don't like that, okay? Because it is not what it seems to be. This is Genesis 9, starting with 18. Let me read for you. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, from whom the whole earth was peopled. Do you notice that only one descendant is listed? Ham, the father of Canaan. Just take note of that for a second. Okay, keeping going, Genesis 9:20. Noah was the first tiller of the soil. He planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and became drunk, and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it upon both of their shoulders, and walked it backwards, and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord my God, be Shem. Let Canaan be his slave. Let God enlarge in Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, but let Canaan be his slave." Okay, that is a lot of cursing of Canaan. For no reason, right? It feels like this is a simple little incident, right? Okay, Ham goes in there and sees Noah in his birthday suit and is like, ah, drunk old dad laying there. He laughs, and his other brothers are like, gosh, that's not funny, and cover him up, right? Wrong. There is something going on here, okay? And the first clue that something going on here is the fact that Canaan is continually listed, not Ham. Do you notice Ham is the one who did the problem, but Canaan is the son of Ham? And Canaan is the one that's cursed, and Canaan is the one that's mentioned. Okay, what is happening here, in short, unfortunately, is maternal incest between Ham and Noah's wife, the result of which is Canaan. What? That seems like a large jump to make. Okay, here's how we know this. Every culture has idioms for sexuality, right? All cultures have commonplace ways of saying sex, right? Making love, for example, right? All cultures do this because it's just, it's a little bit more dignified. The Hebrew culture is no different. In Leviticus 18:6, 18:7, 20:11, and 20:17, we can see examples that the nakedness of the father is an idiom. It means the mother. It means incest. It means maternal incest, okay? So Ham didn't just see his dad naked and make fun of him. He went into the tent when Noah was drunk, when his father was asleep, drunk, not with his mother, not protecting his mother. Does that remind you of Adam, by the way, not protecting his wife? Ham committed maternal incest and his mother bore Canaan. And that's why Canaan is cursed. Poor Canaan. It wasn't Canaan's fault. But anyways, Ham, according to Jewish tradition, was doing this to try to take Noah's authority before Noah gave it to Shem. Shem is the oldest. Shem gets the birthright. Shem is the rightful owner. See how big of a deal this birthright is? According to the Scroll of Jubilee, which is a Dead Sea Scroll, it's not canonical, it's not in the Bible, but it's helpful. It shows that Ham's motivation is trying to take what's not his. And if we look forward to see Ham's descendants, his descendants are the people who do the Tower of Babel, and his descendants are the Assyrians and the Ninevites. They take over the children of Israel later. His descendants also include the Philistines. Think of Goliath fighting little David. And his descendants also include Egypt. They enslave the Israelites. Canaan, those are the people inhabiting the Promised Land that the Israelites have to fight. And Sodom and Gomorrah, the homosexual town that is destroyed by God in the time of Abraham. Okay, that is a really bad rap sheet. Let me just say those again. Babel, Assyria and Nineveh, Philistines, Egypt, Canaan, Sodom and Gomorrah. Those are all from Ham. So you get bad things happening, bad descendants coming. This is like, it's just, I mean, we talk about sometimes like generational cursing, but that is real. Generations of sin can compound on each other. Yeah, you can break free, but... Okay, last little thing here then is the Tower of Babel, okay? And this is short in comparison. If you ask, like, you know, your typical fourth grader, well, actually, I don't know. If you're teaching a fourth grader, how is Noah's covenant broken? You're not going to tell them about the shady tent situation because it's a little bit explicit. You're going to tell them the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel was bad and is a way that God, you know, the relationship with God was hurt again. But the Tower of Babel is secondary to what happens here when Noah is drunk and laying in his tent and not protecting his wife. By the way, I should have said this earlier, but the covenant basically renewed everything that happened with Adam's covenant, but it also added a couple of laws. This is according to the Tosefta Avodah Zarah, okay, which is a Jewish document. It's just Jewish tradition, but it interprets this covenant with Noah to implicitly contain additional commandments, okay? So it's not just don't eat from the tree, because there is no tree not to eat from. Instead, it's no idolatry, blasphemy, sexual immorality, or drunkenness, okay? So what is Noah doing? Drunkenness that leads to sexual immorality of his family, okay? If you notice, the covenants get harder as they go. At the beginning, it's just don't eat from this tree. In a couple minutes here, we'll see it's circumcision. Like, it gets harder as it goes. Okay, back to the Tower of Babel, though. Tower of Babel is Genesis 11, 1 through 9. Starting here, I'm going to read, "Now the whole earth had one language and few words. And as men migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and tower with its top in heaven, and let us make a name for ourselves.'" Okay, part of the problem here is, yes, the arrogance of, you know, we're going to climb up to God, to heaven, you know, we're going to spend all of our time and effort in trying to, you know, be like God, look like God, be arrogant. But part of the problem is right here, make a name for ourselves. The name, according to Jewish tradition, is the birthright. These are the descendants of Ham who don't have the birthright. And they're still trying to usurp power that doesn't belong to them, okay? So they build a city, and it's like they're making a man-made mountain temple. Just like Adam and Eve's sin turned the world evil, and God responded with a flood. Now with Noah's sin, the world turned evil, and Babel happens, and God responds in kind. He doesn't destroy them, but he scatters them. He says, death is worse than sin. Death is better than sin. Scattering them and confusing them is better than letting them sin together. Let's take away their power to sin together. Let's scatter them, and then there they go. From now on, there is going to be a change of plans for God, at least from what we can see. Instead of trying to bring the whole world back, he's going to try to bring the whole world back through one family. He will pick one family. Now it's going to be one family and one nation. Instead of, he was trying to get the whole world. He told Adam, subdue the whole world. He told Noah, subdue the whole world. For Abraham, the next covenant, he's not going to say, go out to the old world. He's going to say, I'm going to take care of your family. And your family is going to be a blessing to the whole world. So it's all, in a sense, he narrows his scope. It's like, have you ever wondered why God didn't pay attention to, like, India or China at this time, or the Native Americans. Why didn't he pay attention to anybody else? He's going to, but through his holy people later. Right now, he is just focusing on one family. Because obviously, with Adam and with Noah, this isn't working. Getting all of mankind is not working. Okay, that's all for page 7.